This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Hundreds of protesters have gathered outside the offices of the United Nations in Bangkok Sunday, demanding action on restoring peace in Myanmar. Most demonstrators were Myanmar citizens living in Thailand. The two countries share a border, and Thailand is home to a very large number of Myanmar nationals. February 1st, the military ousted Aung San Suu Kyi's elected government and declared a year-long state of emergency. Pope Francis, on his last night in Iraq Sunday, met the father of Alan Kurdi, the drowned Syrian Kurdish toddler who became a symbol of the plight of migrants. In a photograph published by the Vatican, the Pope is seen raising his hand as if offering a blessing while looking intently at Alan's father, Abdullah, who has his head bowed. The photos of Alan's tiny body washed up on a Turkish beach in 2015 shocked the world and brought renewed attention to the deadly sea route many migrants take to reach the West. A Saudi-led military coalition mounted airstrikes on Yemen's Houthi-controlled capital Sana'a Sunday after it intercepted 10 drones launched by the Iran-backed rebels, state media reported. The strikes triggered huge explosions in Sana'a, according to an AFP crew at the scene. The rebels reported 7 airstrikes on the capital. The raids come after a sharp escalation in cross-border attacks on the kingdom. The UK government called for the immediate release of a British Iranian woman Sunday after her 5-year sentence for sedition ended in Tehran. Her local MP in London said the 42-year-old dual national has had her ankle tag removed, but faces another court date in Iran next Sunday. She has been under house arrest for months. This is VOA News. Britain's top EU advisor said Sunday the European Union should shake off its ill will and build a good relationship with Britain as sovereign equals. Writing in the Sunday Telegraph, David Frost again defended Britain's unilateral move to smooth post-Brexit trade between Britain and Northern Ireland, over which the EU has promised to launch legal action for breaching terms of the Brexit deal. Since Britain left the EU last year, relations between the two have soured, with both sides accusing the other of acting in bad faith. Swiss voters narrowly backed banning full face covering Sunday, a decision hailed by supporters as a move against radical Islam, but branded sexist and racist by opponents. Official results showed that just more than 51% of voters and a majority of federal Switzerland's cantons supported the proposal. Ivory Coast's main opposition party Sunday claimed victory in a legislative election in the West African nation, alleging that preliminary results were riddled with irregularities. Saturday's vote was a key test of stability 4 months after violence around a disputed presidential poll claimed 87 lives in the former French colony. Two German lawmakers have resigned from posts in Chancellor Angela Merkel's parliamentary group in a scandal over alleged kickback payments for state purchases of respiratory masks in a blow to her party ahead of 2 regional elections. The scandal risks stirring more voter disgruntlement after Germany's ruling coalition of Merkel's CDU and the center-left SPD came under fire for a slow COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Thousands of people across France flocked to vaccination centers Sunday as the government stepped up inoculations against the coronavirus to ease the load on hospitals and stave off further restrictions. French authorities have come under criticism for the slow vaccination rollout, which has so far targeted only the most vulnerable. U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order Sunday making it easier for Americans to vote, the White House says. It coincides with the 56th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday Civil Rights March, when peaceful activists were attacked by police in the southern city of Selma, Alabama. Biden's move comes as Republicans across the country seek to limit voting rights in the wake of the 2020 election, in which former President Donald Trump repeated claims falsely of election fraud. Strong aftershocks from twin earthquakes in Greece last week continue to strike fear in people made homeless and looking for shelter, media reported Sunday. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Biden administration launches its first military strike against Iranian-backed militia targets in eastern Syria. What message does it send to Washington's friends and foes in the region? What are the implications for resuming nuclear negotiations with Iran? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. According to the Associated Press, the Pentagon said the U.S. strikes on February 25 were in retaliation for a rocket attack in Iraq earlier in the month that killed a civilian contractor and wounded a U.S. service member and other coalition troops. Middle East analyst Ellen Lapson, a panelist on this program, writes that the strike was proportionate and carefully calibrated. Lapson says that U.S. President Joe Biden is sending a very different signal to Iraq than the previous Trump administration, which, quote, scolded and bullied the Iraqi government when such attacks occurred, threatening in 2020 to close the U.S. embassy in Baghdad if the Iraqi security forces could not protect Americans present in the country, closed quote. Lapson goes on to say that Biden's message is that the U.S. presence in Iraq is for the shared mission of preventing terrorism from IS or the Islamic State and other extremists. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby underscored another difference between the Biden and Trump administrations by emphasizing that the U.S. military action was taken in full consultation with Washington's coalition partners and was done in conjunction with other diplomatic measures. To underscore the heightened tensions between Iran-backed militant groups in Iraq, the Wall Street Journal reports that on March 3rd, 10 rockets struck the al-Assad military base used by U.S. forces in Iraq. Many analysts say that the Biden administration's strike on the Syrian base used by Iranian-backed militias, such as Khatib Hezbollah and Kataib Said al-Shuhada, was meant to send a dual message to Tehran. The United States will not permit Iran to act with impunity against U.S. forces. At the same time, Washington is prepared to talk with Iran about both nations resuming compliance with the Nuclear Accord, or JCPOA. The Trump administration, as you recall, unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions. In retaliation, Iran ramped up its enrichment activities in violation of the limits imposed by the accord. Currently, the parties cannot agree on who should make the first move. Well, joining us to analyze the impact of the U.S. missile strike on the resumption of nuclear talks with Iran and other regional ramifications are two distinguished Middle East analysts. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. Previously, she held senior national security positions in the U.S. government and served as CEO of the Stimson Center, and Rhonda Slim. She is director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. That's a policy group based here in Washington. She's also a non-resident fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced and International Studies Foreign Policy Institute. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Ellen Lapson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carol. Good to be with you.
And Rhonda Slim, it's a pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you, Carol. Good to be with you and Ellen.
So, Ellen Lapson, let's begin with you. Let's talk about this U.S. strike in Syria on Iran-backed militias. What message was the Biden administration sending with this strike, both to Iraq and other allies, as well as to our adversary, Iran?
Well, I think we should step back and say virtually every president, you know, in the last generation has said they hoped to reduce the entanglements in the Middle East, particularly the use of military force. And yet every president ends up having to respond to some kind of a security threat or attack. So I'm sure the Biden administration was not looking for an opportunity to attack, but felt that the strike, the rockets that fell on both the city of Erbil and the coalition base outside of Erbil in late February, required a response. So I believe it was really intended to be exactly that, a proportional response. We are always stuck in a tit-for-tat. The cycle may not be over yet. It may continue a few more rounds. But hopefully all the parties, whether we're talking about Tehran or Shia militia that are truly Iraqi in terms of command and the choices that are made of when and where to attack, that they are all interested in keeping this below the threshold of major combat. So unfortunately, you know, I think the Biden administration felt they had no choice but to respond to an attack that led to some casualties. It was, I'm told, the physical destruction of the coalition base outside of Erbil is not catastrophic. People are able to still do their work, but it was important to send a signal that that requires a response. It was a defensive measure. It was responding to an attack.
Rhonda Sleem, how do you see this strike? Did they strike, so to speak, the right balance, that is the Biden administration?
Look, there is this tit for tat that's going on now between the Biden administration and Tehran. And we have to see the attacks which preceded the strike on February 25. There were three attacks by Iran-aligned Iraqi militias on bases housing U.S. forces, on the city of Erbil, on the green zone in Baghdad, and then the Biden administration had to respond. So we have to see all of this as part of this chicken game taking place between the United States and Tehran over the JCPOA deal and how the two sides can rejoin the deal eventually if they come to that decision. So the strike on February 25 was proportional, as Alan said, but also it was meant to deter further escalation. And when we talk about the attacks by Iraqi militias, these attacks could not have happened without a consent by the Iranian authorities. These are militias that are funded, directed by the IRGC in Iran. So we have to understand that these attacks are a message also from Tehran to the United States. And so the strike also is a message from the United States to Tehran. And this is all part of this pre-negotiation phase that's taking place between Iran and the United States over the nuclear deal. Now, did it deter the February 25? Well, we had another attack on March 3 by, again, maybe the same or maybe a different Iran-aligned Iraqi militias targeting a base, as Alan said, that is housing U.S. forces that are working with Iraqi forces on fighting ISIS and preventing ISIS from regrouping and emerging in Iraq. It did not. So if the February 25 strike was meant to be a deterrent strike, it did not, since we had the March 3 attack. So what's going to be the response of the Biden administration next? Will they have to respond to the March 3 attack? So we are now stuck in this cycle, which I agree with Alan, is going to stay with us for some time as this pre-negotiation phase between Iran and the United States proceed, eventually, hopefully, leading to the negotiation between the two parties within the framework of the P5+1 on how the two sides can rejoin the JCPOA deal, under what conditions and what steps need to be undertaken, you know, by both sides.
Alan Lapson, Rhonda makes a very interesting point about whether or not this strike on February 25th will deter or maybe escalate, as we saw recently on March 3rd. What is your take? And also, to what extent does Iran have control over these militias in Iraq or operating in Syria? Is Iran in complete control?
You know, we've watched for many years Iran's relationship with Hezbollah of Lebanon, which is truly Iran's greatest strategic success in the region, of creating such a powerful actor from something that started out as kind of a movement that reflected the grievances of the Shia of Iraq. I don't think the Iraqi militia are yet as powerful or important as Hezbollah has become in Lebanese politics. And certainly Rhonda is completely correct that Iran has provided absolutely vital support to these groups. Yet we also see that Iraqi politicians use these groups for their own purposes. So sometimes these Shia militia, certainly when Maliki was prime minister of Iraq, we saw an Iraqi use of these militia in a kind of power struggles within Iraqi politics that may not have been completely directed by Iran. So I think we have to bear that in mind. But on the relationship of these low intensity conflict retaliatory strikes and the larger issue of getting back to negotiate the terms of the Iranian nuclear agreement, I think, yes, everything that happens between Iran and the U.S. in theory is a data point that creates an atmosphere of whether they trust each other enough to go back to the table. Yet, I think for people in the Biden administration, they hope people see that these are kind of two separate functions and two separate purposes. that getting back to the table on the Iran deal has to be on its own merits. It's complicated enough to begin with of who goes first, the sequencing, reciprocity, who's responsible for the original sin of the breakdown of the JCPOA, et cetera. So I believe that on the policy side, people understand that there's kind of interference or it affects the mood in the country, but both Iran and Washington, I think, are giving higher priority to whether they can find common ground to get back to the JCPOA. Iran technically hasn't left the agreement, but it is testing the limits of it. The U.S., of course, in 2018, stepped out of the agreement, and now the Biden administration is still, in principle, strongly committed to getting back in. It's just the tactics of how to do that that we're focused on right now.
Exactly. Back to you, Rhonda. And before we go to a break, after which we'll talk about the JCPOA, how do you view the U.S.-Iraq relationship under the Biden administration as a result of this particular strike? Do you think that it is improving, and how important is that?
I think there is hope on the Iraqi side that there will eventually be a U.S.-Iraq policy, because during the Trump administration, Iraq was viewed through the lens of the Trump maximum pressure strategy on Iran. And the Iraqis and Iraqi officials during the last 4 years felt that the Trump administration did not look at the relationship per se and did not spend time on the relationship. That was the latter part of the Trump administration. The U.S.-Iraq strategic dialogue was launched. And that was a welcome sign by the Iraqis as interest in some parts of the Trump administration of starting to look at the bilateral relationship through its different aspects. It's not only the security aspect, it's also the educational aspect, the economic aspect, the political, the humanitarian aspect. And we have seen the readout from the recent phone calls between President Biden and the Iraqi Prime Minister, Mr. Khademi, as well as between Secretary Blinken and his Iraqi counterpart, Dr. Hussein. There is an interest on both sides on continuing the U.S.-Iraq strategic dialogue. And I think that will be a welcome development going forward and sends the exact right signal to the Iraqi authorities, but also to the Iraqi people, that our relationship with them is not only about fighting ISIS and is not only about the security track, but we are as interested in investing in development, in education, in relation with the Iraqi people. We are still early in the life of the Biden administration to see whether they are going to be investing the time and the resources in the Middle East in general, and not only in Iraq. But that's the hope, is that if the U.S.-Iraq strategic dialogue were to be continued, and we start playing really a smart, long game in Iraq, and not to always think about short-term, but also to invest in long-term programming, again, working with the Iraqi people and not necessarily with just the Iraqi government and the Iraqi official. I think that will be good for both the United States and Iraq.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Rhonda Slim, from whom you just heard, director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. We're discussing the ramifications of the U.S. attack on Iranian-backed militias in eastern Syria and on prospects for reviving the Iran nuclear accord. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a new Twitter follower, Syed Hamza Ahmed from Rampur, India. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our discussion. Over to you, Ellen Lapson, and let's talk about the nuclear agreement. Of course, we know the Biden administration wants to reengage Iran on the nuclear program by reentering the JCPOA, which Trump denounced and withdrew from. So does this particular strike or these tit-for-tat strikes help or hurt those chances? How do you think Iran is interpreting this tactic? Now, we know that it just rejected an EU overture for informal talks. So where does it go from here?
Well, I would be surprised if Iran feels that these attacks fundamentally change the logic of whether we go back to the JCPOA happily and completely or not. I think the Iranians have their own view of the United States as perhaps a declining power. They've seen the volatility of U.S. presidential politics and that they perceive Trump as a very hostile president to them. And yet, in the end, maybe he wasn't quite as tough as he could have been. He never quite took maximum pressure to its maximum extent. I worry that the Iranians now have a very cynical view of the United States. So even though the Biden administration includes many officials that deeply, deeply believed in the JCPOA, Jake Sullivan, Wendy Sherman, Bill Burns, they were all involved in the diplomacy. And, you know, it was a great diplomatic achievement of the Obama years. So while I believe that the foreign policy team around Biden truly want to get back to the JCPOA, they are also sobered by some of the changing realities on the ground. They don't want to appear to be naive or making concessions prematurely to Iran. I think they still see this as a very delicate and complicated process to try to restore enough trust to get the Iranians to roll back some of their testing of the JCPOA. And so I think it's very tricky. Again, my final point is I'm not persuaded that these attacks in Iraq fundamentally change the Iranians' calculation. I think the Iranians are conflicted about whether it will be good enough for them to go back into the agreement. They don't want to look weak. They have presidential elections coming up. I think rebuilding some modicum of trust on both sides, but particularly on the Iranian side, is going to be very challenging. And I think the Biden administration understands the nonproliferation community has been pressing for dramatic early gestures by the Biden administration, show the Iranians good faith. And they've been quite frustrated that the Biden administration hasn't opened the aperture even wider to try to restart these talks. But I think the people inside government understand this is very tricky, and their instinct of caution, I think, has kicked in.
So, Ron Nisleem, I'd like to get your view about the resumption of talks, if you think the Biden administration is approaching these talks in a wise manner, or are you worried, as Ellen said, that Iran has this very cynical view of the United States, notwithstanding a less belligerent administration? Obviously, there are internal politics in Iran that will probably affect resumption of talks. And we have also the Biden administration saying, unlike the Obama administration, they don't want to necessarily divorce these talks from Iran's malign activities in the region, as we just saw.
And I think that's why the February 25 strike sent the right message to the United States allies, especially Gulf Arab allies, who were always worried that the Biden administration would repeat what the Obama administration did by focusing too much on the Iranian nuclear program and trying to reach and eventually preserve this nuclear deal, that they did not pay attention to what for these Gulf Arab allies is the number one concern vis-a-vis Iran, which is Iranian malign activities in their neighborhood. And so the February 25 strike, although it was proportional, limited, was very much welcome in the region because it was an indication that the modus operandi of the Biden administration is not going to be a repeat of the Obama administration, that the Biden administration learned lessons from its experience negotiating with Iran and the aftermath of that during the Obama administration. And so I think both countries, the United States and Iran, are interested in an agreement. U.S. is interested in boxing, as I think Secretary Blinken said, the Iranian nuclear program, and then use that once these negotiations are completed on the Iranian nuclear programs, whether it's compliance for compliance or some other analyst said less for less, or whether there is an interim deal. So the interest on the U.S. side is to use that as a platform to negotiate, as they put it, stronger and longer deal, and also address these other issues of concern about Iran, ballistic missiles program and the malign activities of Iran in the Middle East. On the Iranian side, they are definitely interested primarily in lifting the sanctions. And they see this return to the JCPOA by the United States as a way to lift these sanctions. Now, the question, as Ellen said, is how you do this. There is a problem of sequencing of steps you know, even if it's compliance for compliance, how they're going to do that. It's a complex problem set in a way that we are dealing with. And I think the Biden administration is doing it exactly right in terms of saying today is different from 2015. Dynamics in the region have changed. The dynamics around the Iranian nuclear program have changed. And our domestic politics here in the United States have changed because there have been lessons learned over the years from how Iran has implemented this deal, but also what Iran has done in response to the 2018 decision by the Trump administration to walk out of the deal. Eventually, there will be a creative solution to how the two sides can negotiate some kind of an agreement that can meet the minimum interest of both sides, Iran and the United States.
So turning back to you, Ellen Leibson, we'll have to continue this conversation, but I wanted to touch briefly on the fact that this month marks the 10th anniversary of the democratic uprising in Syria against the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad, which we know morphed into civil conflict and a proxy war. We've seen the worst refugee crisis since World War II. That this conflict has spawned. Briefly, to what extent do you think that Iran's role in Syria and the U.S. reaction to it could also change? You touched on this in your recent article, that the Biden administration will no longer deal with Syria in terms of its impact on the Iran nuclear deal, but that it may take more decisive action against the Assad regime.
I guess I would only say I would not expect a surge of new diplomatic activity on the U.S. part to try to get to the end of the Syrian civil war. But you have to kind of step back and say there's also the Russia angle and the Israeli angle. And so I think Syria will come up a lot in regional interactions. I think the Israelis are starting to signal that setting red lines for Iran in Syria is as important to them as nuclear talks. So I think the administration will have to be dealing with Syria directly and indirectly. There's the Turkey factor and the Kurds and Syria. There's just so many different parts to it. But in terms of regional conflicts more generally, it looks that the Biden administration sees Yemen as the earliest opportunity. And because the stakes are not that high for Iran in Yemen, one could imagine the Iranians finding a way to make a gesture there, where I think the Iranians making a gesture in Syria is probably harder for them.
Let me get Rhonda to respond, because Syria is a serious bridge for the Iranians to Lebanon, to Hezbollah, and Iran has been obviously one of the major backers of Bashar al-Assad and has enabled him to brutalize his population. How do you see it, Rhonda?
I think diplomacy on Syria, despite definitely I agree with Ellen that there is an interest on the part of the Biden administration to do more diplomacy on Syria. Secretary Blinken was one of the first Obama administration officials who basically said what happened in Syria and the lack of action by the Obama administration on Syria was a shame he's going to carry to his grave. Personally for him, and in off-the-record meetings, he expressed the same kind of feeling of it is somehow a moral responsibility to rectify that situation. However, when you press them, whether it's Secretary Blinken or others on that, they are very much short on specifics. But one thing that they have said is focus more on diplomacy, work more on the Geneva process of negotiation led by the UN between the government and the opposition, and no longer lead from behind. Focus on the humanitarian aspects. And there is this issue that's going to come up this summer, and Russia has already indicated it's going to oppose cross-border humanitarian assistance. And that means that you have the whole part of Syria, especially in the northwest, where you have more than 3 million people living who are not going to have access, which they cannot live without. One of the first policy issues that is going to face the Biden administration is how can we work outside of the UN on this? Many tough policy decisions that they are going to face, whether it's on the humanitarian front, whether it is on the assistance to the Syrian Kurds, whether it is on Iran. And that's where the strike on February 25 is important. Again, the way it was read by Syrians, the way it was read in the region, that the Biden administration, unlike the Obama administration, is not going to hold Syria policy hostage to the negotiation with Iran.
Very good point. Some analysts say that without the Assad regime, Iran's entire regional foreign policy would be undermined. We'll have to see in the months ahead. For now, that's just about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ellen Leibson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Rhonda Slame,
director of the Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is made for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. These are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel talks about a proposed law that could make it easier for foreign STEM students to stay and work in the United States. Susan Shand will talk about poverty in China. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
On his first day in office, President Joe Biden said he was sending a bill to Congress called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. The aim of the bill is to provide ways to give more immigrants the chance to gain citizenship. The bill also proposes to make it easier for graduates of U.S. universities with advanced STEM degrees to stay in the United States. STEM is a term that describes the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The bill was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives on February 18th and will have to be debated in the House and the Senate. However, many of the ideas in the bill are in line with what many university officials want to see. Stephen Tightsworth is a professor and the director of graduate studies for the physics department at Duke University in North Carolina. Tightsworth said Duke has about 80 graduate students in physics this year. He said his department has not seen less interest in its program over the last few years. He thinks this is because Duke is a private university and does not receive a significant amount of state funding for its programs. But he said his students are worried that they will not be able to stay in the U.S. once they graduate. They currently live in the U.S. with student visas. Tightsworth thinks it is important for the U.S. government to make clear, consistent policy decisions related to foreign students being able to work in the country.
The big issue is just greater clarity, consistency, and consistency from year to year, not, you know, having policies change on a dime. I think consistency and predictability are really going to be critical so that our students can focus on doing great research.
Many foreign graduate students who were accepted to U.S. universities for the 2020-2021 academic year chose not to come. That was because of the coronavirus health crisis. However, the number of foreign graduate students had already been decreasing. Some experts who follow higher education say doctoral programs in other countries like Great Britain and Australia are getting more competitive with American ones. Earlier this year, the American Council on Education wrote a guide for how American universities should think about foreign students. It offered ideas to deal with what it described as falling numbers of international students starting in 2015. Teitsworth, the Duke professor, said if new foreign worker rules are put into place, it would be good news for higher education in the U.S. He added that it would also be good news for students who are worried about coming to the U.S. to study.
So I think it's very significant, obviously. Certainly for the many students who will choose to stay in the U.S. and have great careers here. But even for those who go elsewhere, it shows that the welcome mat is out and a spirit of collaboration. So I think it's really a win-win situation from that point of view.
Even if the universities do not get exactly what they want, the legislation seems to support their goals. During his presidential campaign, Biden himself said that he did not want to prevent some skilled young people from staying in the U.S. if they can provide something good for the world economy. I'm Dan Friedell.
Now let's hear from Susan Shand.
China opened the yearly meeting of its top legislative advisory body, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, on Thursday. The CPPCC leader praised President Xi Jinping's government's COVID-19 response and reported, in his words, an all-round victory in China's fight against poverty. Last week, President Xi made similar comments in a ceremony celebrating the progress on poverty reduction. He declared extreme poverty had been ended in China. All 98.99 million people who are the poor rural population have been taken out of poverty, he said. In 2012, Xi began a plan that has helped China go beyond the World Bank's 2030 target for ending extreme poverty. Official media broadcast the ceremony last week to millions of people. Xi told citizens that the government had spent about $246 billion to fight poverty over the last 8 years. Xi said these people no longer need to worry about being able to buy food and clothes. He also said the government will guarantee health care, housing, and education. The People's Daily, official newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, called the ending of poverty historic. Just this past Sunday, China released what it calls the number one policy document. It promised to keep fighting poverty while changing the plan to what China calls rural revitalization. Experts quoted by the state-owned Chinese newspaper, The Global Times, said the new policy will work to help communities in rural areas need less government assistance. This would be done by creating many new jobs in large infrastructure projects, the experts added. However, in defining poverty, China continues to use the World Bank's measure for establishing the world's poorest countries. But the World Bank considers China among upper middle-earning economies. Also, China defines a person who lives in rural poverty as someone who lives on $1.69 each day, reports Reuters. The World Bank defines it as someone who lives on $1.90 each day. In looking at the Chinese economy, Brookings Institution economist Dermot Gill wrote that measuring progress using the official poverty lines of the world's poorest countries is the very definition of underachievement. Xi and the official media remained largely silent about more than 40 years of market-style economic reforms that began with opening China to foreign investment after the Cultural Revolution. Xi's declaration of the end of poverty in China conflicted with a statement by Chinese Premier Li Keqiang last May. There are over 600 million people whose monthly income is barely $140, not enough to rent a room in Chinese cities, he said at his yearly press conference. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in American English. Today, we talk about a common idiom from sports: to raise the bar. To raise the bar means to set a high standard and to raise expectations. It can also mean to set higher goals. You can raise the bar for yourself or for others. But we often use this expression when someone's performance is much better than others. When you raise the bar, you increase the expectations of people who have settled into a way of doing things. For example, let's say a person is really good at playing a video game. If he joins a team game, his skill level will raise the bar. The other players will have to play better to come up to the new level of competition. When you use the expression, you can sometimes put a word before bar. This will describe the situation better. For example, when a new intern started at VOA Learning English for his fall semester, he would wear a suit during online video meetings. Most of us, who had been working at home for many months, did not dress up. We looked presentable, but our clothes were not formal. So he really raised the clothing bar for our weekly meetings. Here is another example. Let's say you are invited to go to a potluck party. At a potluck party, everyone is supposed to bring one thing to drink or eat. You make a very tasty cake with four layers and fancy decorations. The host might say, "Wow, you really raised the potluck bar for the rest of the people at the party." Word experts say people began using the idiom "raise the bar" around the turn of the 20th century. It comes from the sport of track and field, specifically the high jump and the pole vault events. These events involve raising a bar incrementally or a little at a time to see how high the athletes can jump or vault over a bar. Now, let's hear these two friends use the expression together.
How's the new job going?
Great. I go into the office an hour early every day and stay late almost every night. Plus, I get all my work done days ahead of my deadlines.
Aren't you worried that you might be raising the bar a bit too high?
No way. If other people can't perform as well, that's good for me, right?
Well, you don't want to raise the bar so high that one day you have trouble getting over it.
You know, that's a really good point. I never thought of it like that.
That's what friends are for.
Maybe I'll ease up a little bit.
Good idea.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Words and Their Stories. When it comes to teaching American English, we hope we raise the bar just a little bit higher for English learners. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
I want to say to you that for the next 4 years, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and you're looking at him.
Presidential elections are exciting events in American politics. Few elections for the White House have been as exciting as the one in 1948. And few have had such surprising results.
This is NBC Television.
We have obtained the results from the state of Ohio, which assures victory for President Truman and Senator Barkley. With Ohio's 25 electoral votes, President Truman and Senator Barkley will have a total of 266 votes in the Electoral College. This is the minimum figure necessary for victory.
Four candidates were nominated for president in the 1948 election. One was the man already in the White House, the candidate of the Democratic Party, President Harry S. Truman. Truman had been the party's vice presidential candidate with Franklin Roosevelt in 1944. When Roosevelt died a year later, Truman became president. He was the one who made the decision to drop atomic bombs on Japan to end World War II. But Truman did not do well during his first few months in office. He made several serious mistakes. He had trouble with the economy and organized labor. His party lost control of the Senate and the House of Representatives in the congressional elections of 1946. Most Americans had little faith in Truman's ability as a leader. They expected that he would lose the presidential election in 1948 if he chose to be a candidate. President Truman did choose to run. He took several strong steps to show his leadership in the months following the Democratic defeat in the congressional elections. Truman called on Congress to pass a number of laws to help black people. He took firm actions in his foreign policy toward the Soviet Union. These included the Marshall Plan and the Berlin Airlift, as we discussed in our last two programs. And he began to speak out with much more strength to the American people. Truman succeeded in winning the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. He chose Alban Barkley, a senator from Alabama, for vice president. Senator Barkley and I will win this election, and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that, Truman declared in accepting the nomination. The Republicans nominated New York State Governor Thomas Dewey. Dewey was a wise and courageous man. He was also very serious. Truman campaigned by telling the voters that Dewey did not understand the needs of the average American. He called Dewey a candidate of rich people. One day, Dewey got angry at a railroad engineer because his campaign train was late for a speech. Truman said this proved that Dewey did not understand the problems of railroad engineers and other working Americans. He tried to make the election a choice between hard-working Democrats and rich Republicans. Two other men also were candidates for the presidency. Both were from newly created parties. One was Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. He was a candidate of the States' Rights Democratic Party, also known as the Dixiecrat Party. Most of his supporters were white people from the southeastern part of the country. They opposed giving full rights to black people. The other candidate was Henry Wallace of the Progressive Party. His supporters believed that Truman had turned away from the progressive ideas of Franklin Roosevelt. Both Thurmond and Wallace had broken away from the Democratic Party. Most political experts believed these two candidates would take votes away from President Truman. They believed the Republican Dewey would surely win the election. President Truman did not have strong public support. But Harry Truman was a fighter. He did not believe the election was lost. He took his campaign to the American people.
On election day, the president, the Congress, the governor, the mayor, all sits as the government. You are the government, because then you decide what sort of a government you want. And when you do like you did in 1946, when two-thirds of you stayed home, you get just what you deserve. You got that good-for-nothing 80th Congress.
He said he had always campaigned by going around, meeting, and talking to people. Running for president was no different, he said. He just got on a train and started across the country to tell people what was going on. He wanted to talk to them face to face. When you stand there in front of them and talk to them, he said, the people can tell whether you are telling them the facts or not.
If you give the Republicans complete control of this government, you might just as well turn it over to the special interests, and we'll start on a boom and bust cycle and try to go through just what we did in the 20s and end up with a crash, which in the long run will do nobody any good but the communists.
Truman campaigned with great energy. He made hundreds of speeches as his train crossed the country. It became known as the Whistle Stop Campaign because it stopped at some of the smallest towns and villages in the country. Truman gave speeches from the back of his campaign train, the Ferdinand Magellan. He spoke to farmers in Iowa. He visited a children's home in Texas. And he discussed issues with small groups of people who came to visit his train when it stopped in rural areas of Montana and Idaho. Dewey and the Republicans laughed at Truman's campaign. They said it showed that Truman needed votes so badly that he had to spend his time looking for them in small villages. Truman said the criticism proved that Republicans did not care for the average American. Dewey also campaigned across the country by train. but he showed little of the fire and emotion in his speeches that made Truman's campaign so exciting. Dewey's speeches were safe. One reporter wrote that Dewey was acting like a man who had already been elected and was only passing time waiting to take office. Dewey had good reasons to feel so sure of being elected. Almost every political expert in the country said Truman had no chance of winning. The Wall Street Journal, for example, printed a story about what Dewey would do in the White House after the election. And the New York Times said that Dewey would win the election by a large majority. Truman refused to accept those views. Instead, he spoke with more and more emotion against Dewey. Most Americans still believed that Truman would lose, but they liked his courage in fighting until the end. One supporter shouted, "Give 'em hell, Harry," them being the Republicans. Soon, supporters across the country were shouting, "Give 'em hell, Harry." Truman made special appeals to working people, Jews, blacks, Catholics, and other traditional supporters of the Democratic Party. In his final radio speech before the election, he promised to work for peace and a government that would help all people. Then he went to his home in the state of Missouri to wait with the rest of the country for the election results. Republicans across the country greeted Election Day happily. They were sure that this was the day that the people would choose to send a Republican back to the White House after 16 years. Some of the early voting results from the northeastern states showed Truman winning. But few Republicans worried. They were sure Dewey would be the winner when all the votes were counted. The Chicago Tribune was also sure who the next president would be, declaring in a huge headline, "Dewey defeats Truman." But the newspaper was wrong. Everyone was wrong. Everyone, that is, except Harry Truman and the Americans who gave him their votes. Truman went to bed on election night before all the votes were counted. He told his assistant that he would win. He awoke early the next morning to learn that he was right. Not only did he defeat Dewey, as he thought he would, but he won by a good number of votes. And he helped many Democratic congressional candidates win as well. The Democrats captured both houses of Congress. After the results were announced, as heard in this old recording, Truman showed his sense of humor by joking about the predictions of his defeat.
I had on the National Broadcasting Company, and Kelton Bourne was saying, "While the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear from the..." "Very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority." And I went back to bed and went to sleep.
Harry Truman would make many difficult decisions as America moved into the second half of the 20th century. Truman would send American troops to help the United Nations defend South Korea against aggression from the North. He would join other Western leaders in establishing a new alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They established NATO to provide for the joint defense of Europe and North America. Truman and later presidents would make decisions to send large amounts of economic and military aid to countries around the world. Many of these decisions were necessary because of America's new responsibilities after World War II as leader of the Western world.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.